Wayne. Last June, the U.S. Supreme Court made history with several of its rulings, striking down parts of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, and then the next day striking down a portion of the Defense of Marriage Act that was passed during the Clinton administration. A year earlier, it had upheld the Affordable Care Act, which allowed that law to be implemented. The court's new session began last week and will be ruling on other important issues, including campaign finance, affirmative action, abortion, executive power, prayer, and more. We asked Jeffrey Rosen to share some of his thoughts and observations about the Roberts Court and the cases before it. He's the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, just across the street from us here in Philadelphia. Also legal affairs editor at the New Republic. And Jeffrey Rosen, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's wonderful to be back.
And to our listeners, lines open. Any questions or comments that you might have, phone number 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. Well, every Supreme Court session, of course, is significant, is important. Is there anything unusual or significant about what the court is going to be dealing with this session?
Well, of course, there's so much. Last term is a hard act to follow with voting rights, as you said, and marriage equality and the future of affirmative action. That was one of the most significant blockbuster terms in recent memory. But we've got some extremely important cases this year, including just on Tuesday, on the second day of the term, the court heard a case that may determine the future of campaign finance reform. And there's much, much, much more as well.
And I do want to pick up on that. But I think if we have learned anything, and looking back at some of these decisions, the Voting Rights Act and the Defense of Marriage Act, I mean, very quickly you see states responding with new laws and taking what the court decided and implementing it in one way or another.
Isn't it interesting? After all, in the Defense of Marriage Act case, the majority, per Justice Kennedy, said, we're just deciding the fate of this federal Defense of Marriage Act law. We're not saying anything about state marriage laws. And Justice Scalia predicted apocalyptically, this is going to mean that every state marriage law is going to be challenged as well. And lo and behold, Attorney General Kathleen Kane at the National Constitution Center in July announced that she was refusing to defend Pennsylvania's marriage law, which limits marriage to a man and a woman, invoking the Defense of Marriage Act case. And that case is now being litigated up through the lower court. So you're absolutely right that regardless of how some justices may want to limit the scope of their decisions, litigants around the country are leaping on them and trying to implement this as quickly as possible.
And the Voting Rights Act as well. I mean, within hours, states were making changes in some of their voting rights laws.
They were. And then just recently, Attorney General Eric Holder announced that he would file suit against North Carolina's redistricting as well as their voter ID law, invoking sections of the Voting Rights Act that the Supreme Court left intact after its very important decision striking down part of the Voting Rights Act. So, and Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg was at the National Constitution Center in September. I was just thrilled we had 800 people turn out to see her. Just remind, it was a remarkable conversation. And she talked about that voting rights suit, and she expressed hope that the remaining provisions of the Voting Rights Act would allow the Attorney General to continue to defend voting rights.
We've seen this court, or I guess heard this court in action. Only a handful of people get to actually see it in action. But and you mentioned Justice Ginsburg. Do you see it operating in any way on predictable lines? I mean, Kennedy seems to be that swing vote, and you've got Kagan and Sotomayor and sort of on one side, and you've got other justices on the other side. Is that how we should think of this Roberts Court?
On the one hand, it's true that there are a lot of important decisions that divide along predictable ideological lines of five Republicans against four Democrats, and that's a reality, and that the voting rights case was one of those. But there are important cases where the various camps break ranks, most notably, of course, in the famous Affordable Care Act case last term, where Chief Justice John Roberts surprised many by casting a tie-breaking vote with the liberals to uphold the core of the Affordable Care Act as a tax. Now, Justice Roberts seems to have been motivated in that case by a concern for the institutional legitimacy of the court. And he said in interviews over the years that he thinks it's bad for the court and bad for the country when citizens see the five Republicans against four Democrats. So one big, big question this year is, will he continue to show that institution-mindedness in cases like campaign finance and affirmative action? Or in cases which he feels very strongly about, as he does in those two areas, is he more interested in getting it right than in formulating some kind of consensus. That's going to be a big drama for this term.
Well, talking about campaign finance last week, the court heard a case of McCutcheon v. FEC. Is there a shorthand version of or description of what this case involves?
Sure. First of all, the best way to find the shorthand version is to go to the National Constitution Center's new podcast about it. We're starting a new series where we bring together debaters from all sides of these issues, and it's up on our website, constitutioncenter.org. But the question in that case is whether aggregate limits on campaign contributions are consistent with the First Amendment. Ever since the Buckley versus Valeo case in the 1970s, the court said that there's more ability to restrict campaign contributions than expenditures, because campaign expenditures are closer to the core of political speech and also less likely to lead to corruption than a contribution to a candidate. And here there's someone who wanted to give a certain amount of money. It was a patriotic number, 1776 dollars or something like that, to the Republican National Committee, to a senatorial committee, to state committees. And because of aggregate limits on the amounts that can be contributed, the person's contributions were capped. And the claim is that these caps violate the First Amendment. The reason the case is so hugely significant is because several justices, including Justice Clarence Thomas, want to use this case to overturn this longstanding distinction, which says that expenditures can be limited, but contributions can be limited more than expenditures, and basically say no limits on either contributions or expenditures because the First Amendment prohibits it. That would be a revolution in campaign finance law of even greater effect than the Citizens United case, which said that corporations are persons with free speech rights. And much of the case turns on the question of what kind of corruption can Congress legitimately avoid, and are contributions corrupting.
But do you see this case as having, in a sense, grown out of Citizens United, which gave corporations, gave labor unions the sort of unlimited, the right to give unlimited contributions to some of these outside organizations?
It grew out of Citizens United only in the sense that the five justices in Citizens United, the five conservative justices, made clear that they think that the First Amendment really limits what kind of campaign contributions and expenditures Congress can regulate. And Citizens United also, and this is most significant, defined the kind of corruption that can be regulated very narrowly. It said it has to be evidence of quid pro quo corruption. And in the oral argument on Tuesday, Solicitor General Don Verrilli said, well, you don't want the Secretary of Defense to be bribed with a Maserati, that basically someone offers him a fancy car in exchange for a favor. If you define corruption that narrowly, the justices were kind of tying themselves in knots about it. Well, why is an aggregate limit on contributions likely to avoid that kind of quid pro quo corruption any more than a limit on expenditures? There was a very interesting brief filed by Professor Lawrence Lessig of Harvard Law School in the case, which said this definition of contributions, or rather of corruption, which the court embraced in the Citizens United case, is far too narrow. In fact, the framers of the Constitution, said Lessig, understood corruption to mean the dependence of institutions like the House of Representatives on a small group of rich aristocrats rather than on the people themselves. And if you define corruption more broadly in this sense, Lessig says, then both expenditures and contributions can be limited basically to prevent big money from influencing politics, even if there's no evidence of actual bribes.
The idea being that the more money you have, the more speech you have? I mean, is that one of the arguments?
The people who want to limit contributions and expenditures say, look, the need to raise huge amounts of money means that candidates are going to be dependent on donors and their worldview, regardless of whether or not they're being bribed. Basically, you have to, if you buck the worldview of Google or of a couple big money donors, you're not going to get that money, and you won't be a viable candidate. The case on the other side says money is speech, that both expenditures and contributions are ways that people express their political views, and therefore neither should be regulated. And in fact, the effort to equalize the voices of the few so that the many can be heard more is antithetical to the First Amendment. So it's really two clashing views of what free speech and what equality require.
And this quid pro quo about, as you say, the Maserati example, which is that you vote this way, I give you a Maserati. But that's, it seems to me, in politics, that, first of all, I mean, that's so hard to prove, right?
Of course.
I mean, it's such a rarity. obviously. It's more like someone gives a lot of money and representatives, there are two phones that are ringing, one call from the person who gives a lot of money and one who gave no money at all. Whose phone call do they answer?
Oh, exactly right. Very few people are clumsy enough to offer a Maserati because you don't have to do that. Just the knowledge that you're dependent on these big contributions will get your phones influenced first. Now, in the Citizens United case, the court said this influence corruption or gratitude corruption, basically the idea that you're likely to pay more attention to big money donors than small ones, is not a cognizable First Amendment interest. They said only evidence of quid pro quo corruption can be regulated. Mm. That really dramatically restricts the kind of abuses that Congress can regulate. And that's why this debate about would the framers of the Constitution have agreed with this limited notion of corruption, and is Justice Thomas, who in most cases claims to care about the original understanding of the Constitution, is he wrong not to embrace this broader version of dependence corruption, as Lessig puts it, that James Madison and the other framers were so concerned about?
But how did money and speech get tied up together? I mean, I realize that probably goes back to Buckley, but it sort of doesn't – I struggle with that personally.
You know, it's worth struggling with, and people have different intuitions about it. I love discussing the Buckley case with students or anyone, and often groups will divide. Some people feel that, yes, money is speech because you need money to get your message out, and political ads are core political speech, and the framers of the Constitution understood that buying ads was necessary for promoting speech and so forth. And others feel, as you seem to, that money is not speech. Mm-hmm. That speech is speech, and that money is money. And there are plenty of forms of commercial advertising, for example, that we regulate that get less First Amendment protection than core political speech. And that there's a separate interest in ensuring that the voices of the few rich people don't drown out the voices of many ordinary citizens. And that equalization of the playing field is as much of a First Amendment interest, as Justice Breyer puts it, as the effort to protect money. So there are strongly different views about this question.
And we're almost up on a break here, and I know it's hard to judge how a court is going to rule, but having watched and listened to them argue this, do you have a sense of where they're going to end up?
Chief Justice Roberts, seemed to be struggling for some kind of compromise that might strike down some of the aggregate limits, but preserve the broader Buckley framework. And he said, why don't we just forbid the various organizations, the Republican National Committee and the state committees, from transferring money to each other? That would avoid the corruption. And you could do that and also strike down the limits, but preserve limits on individual contributions in other cases. So the basic question, I think most people expect the limits to be struck down in some form, but uh-huh. The question is how broadly will that be, and will that call all of campaign finance regulation into question?
That's Jeffrey Rosen, President and CEO of the National Constitution Center, also legal affairs editor of the New Republic. We are talking about the U.S. Supreme Court and the various cases that have been and will be argued before the court this session. And lines are open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org.
Supporting WHYY, the Children's Beach House, and the third annual Plein Air Brandywine Valley, a painting and photography competition, exhibition, and sale. For 1 week, 100 painters and photographers will interpret the beauty of the Brandywine Valley. Their work will be judged, on display, and available at the opening gala Friday, October 25th at the Winterthur Museum in Wilmington. The art show and sale continues throughout the weekend and is open to the public. For gala tickets and schedules, pleinairbrandywinevalley.org.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, are there enough people trained in the so-called STEM fields, scientists, engineers, mathematicians? One observer says yes.
You can go basically every 5 to 10 years and find study after study that says there isn't a shortage, yet we hear this persistent cry of a shortage.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WVUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Moore College of Art and Design joins you in support of WHYY and will host its open house on Sunday, October 27th from 2 to 4 p.m. for its career-focused co-ed graduate studies programs taught by professionally active faculty in an intimate campus environment on the Parkway. Alumni, faculty, and program managers will be available for you to speak with, and the galleries at Moore and the Art Shop will be open. For more on Moore College of Art and Design's October 27th open house, moore.edu or 215-965-4016.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. If you're just joining us, Jeffrey Rosen is our guest, the new CEO of the National Constitution Center, which is here in Philadelphia across the street from WHYY. Also, legal affairs editor of the New Republic. We're talking about the cases that will be and are being argued before the U.S. Supreme Court, why this matters, what we should think about when it comes to these very important court decisions. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-7999. This note: on Tuesday, October 29th, the National Constitution Center's first Town Hall Tuesday will be held. The panelists will be engaging in a constitutional debate about the shutdown and the debt ceiling crises. And among the guests, Sean Wilentz from Princeton University had a very interesting op-ed in the New York Times last week. And George Washington University's Neil Buchanan. So you can check that out as well. And of course, joining us here on Radio Times. Now, this week, the court is going to hear a case called Schuett v. Coalition to Defend Affirmative Action. What's at stake here?
This is an important case and an interesting one. So the question is whether Michigan voters who banned affirmative action by popular referendum after the court allowed it in a 2003 case called the Grutter case, whether that referendum is unconstitutional. And the basic question is, does a law that forbids race consciousness and requires colorblindness violate the Equal Protection Clause? And it's a rather interesting claim. The argument goes that by changing the political process and forcing supporters of affirmative action to have to go to the back to the initiative process to repeal the referendum, the voters violated the political process rights of minorities whose interests are harmed by this referendum. Now, the argument on the other side is that a Supreme Court that already said many of the justices believe that the Constitution actually forbids affirmative action is very unlikely to hold that it requires affirmative action. And even the liberal justices who don't want to ban all affirmative action might be reluctant to say when a state chooses on its own to ban affirmative action, as Michigan and California and other states have done, that's permissible and there's no requirement that that they go one way or the other. Interestingly, California, whose executive filed a brief in this Michigan case basically asking the court to strike down the Michigan initiative. The governor's office in California said, even though we've got one of these initiatives too, we don't think it's constitutional and we'd like the court to strike it down. I think the betting is that this initiative is not going to be struck down. Certainly the five conservatives led by Justice Kennedy are, it's inconceivable that they would hold that there was a constitutional requirement of affirmative action. It'll be interesting to see whether any liberals join them. But in some ways, this case is, although very important, less significant than the Fisher case that the Supreme Court heard last year, and which really raised the question of the future of affirmative action in higher education more generally. And in that case, the court punted and sent back to the lower courts the question of whether Texas, which has a 10% plan requiring the admission of the top 10% of all students in Texas high schools, and then adds an additional affirmative action program on top of that, the court said, let's go back to the lower courts to find out whether that pop-up affirmative action plan is or is not constitutional. That case may come back to the Supreme Court and raise the question of whether the justices are going to overturn that 2003 case I mentioned, which said that affirmative action is permissible. And that would be a huge deal. Overturning the Grutter case would not just ban affirmative action in a particular state like Michigan. It would forbid affirmative action in public education across the entire country if the court said the Constitution forbids affirmative action. So that's really the difference between these two cases. One is, can each state decide for its own? And the other says, is the Supreme Court going to impose a single solution on the entire country?
And that was the case when then-Justice Sandra Day O'Connor talked about the goal of diversity. I mean, the importance of diversity to college-university campuses.
That's exactly right. Justice O'Connor said that both the First Amendment and the Equal Protection Clause allow universities to pursue the educational benefit of diversity and that it's good for students as a whole. There are several justices, now that Justice O'Connor has been replaced by Justice Samuel Alito, who reject the idea that diversity is a compelling interest. They say the only permissible grounds for affirmative action is to correct identifiable examples of past discrimination by a particular university. And if, as in Michigan, there's no evidence that the university itself discriminated, at least recently, right, these justices would say affirmative action is impermissible.
Well, what's interesting, there are certain issues, affirmative action being one of them, that just keep coming back to the court. I mean, obviously, as there are cases that are brought from various states and various universities or public institutions trying out their own versions of affirmative action, it's such an unsettled law, I guess, or issue.
It is. And you know, we were talking earlier about the response to the gay marriage decision and how immediately states like Pennsylvania litigated their own laws. It's interesting here, too, to see the Supreme Court issues a big decision in 2003, and far from that settling the question, that just energizes voters in Michigan and elsewhere to come up with their own solution and to try to repudiate the court's decision. So one thing we're seeing very much is that the Supreme Court does not and cannot solve these great constitutional issues on its own. It creates a dialogue between the courts, Congress, ordinary citizens, and the executive, and that's really the way that's the way it's supposed to be.
And the court picks and chooses these cases. So it's interesting to see what cases they agree to rule on.
It is. The court has great discretion over its own docket. Only a very small category of cases are mandated by the Constitution to be heard by the Supreme Court. That's called its original jurisdiction. But broadly, they can hear or not hear whatever they like. In recent years, they've been hearing fewer and fewer cases, fewer than 80 a year. I think there are only 60-some-odd on the docket so far, but more will come up. Generally, the best way to get your case heard by the Supreme Court is to have a disagreement among the lower courts. So, for example, there's an important disagreement about whether the health care mandate for contraception, which includes an exception for religious organizations, also needs to have an exception for non-religious employers who say that their religious beliefs are offended by having to cover contraception. And the lower courts have split about that, so there's a decent case, a strong case, that the Supreme Court may hear that this term. And there the question is, does the First Amendment's guarantee of rights of free exercise of religion require that non-religious employers be allowed to opt out of covering contraception if they have religious objections to it?
Well, and because we're talking about this while the Affordable Care Act is being debated, I mean, again, a very contentious piece of this legislation.
It is, and there are so many parts of this legislation that continue to be litigated. Just if we thought, here's another example, if we thought that Chief Justice Roberts ended the debate in June with his vote, that's not at all the case. Not only is this aspect of the Affordable Care Act being litigated, there are other challenges to whether or not the president delegated too much authority to the implementing agencies. Others claim that by deciding to delay the implementation of the employer mandate for a year, he's violating his constitutional obligation to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. And then, of course, there's the political debate in Congress and the attempt to defund the Affordable Care Act. So the political and constitutional drama continues big time.
And lawyers are gamefully being employed to deal with all these issues.
You could say it's bad news for the country, but good news for the National Constitution Center, because we're going to host all of these fascinating debates.
And that's Jeffrey Rosen. He is the president CEO of the National Constitution Center, again, here in Philadelphia, a job he took on, earlier this year, was it?
In June,
not so long ago.
I have to say, every day I feel like I've gone to constitutional heaven. This is the best job in the world, and it's such a wonderful place.
And he's also legal affairs editor of the New Republic, and we invited him to join us today in Radio Times, frankly, to pick his brain about some important cases that are being argued before this U.S. Supreme Court, cases that could affect your life. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And if there's one thing we have learned in the last couple of years, is what the Supreme Court decides has a huge impact on people's individual lives and certainly on the country as well. I noticed, Jeffrey, that so many of the rulings are 5-4. And I know when Justice Roberts began, he wanted to get away from that. He wanted to have much more majority decisions. Why does it sort of end up 5-4, do you think?
He did want to get away from that. And I think we've talked about this on the show before. I mean, he gave an interview to several journalists, including me, saying he thought it was bad for the court and bad for the country to have these 5-4 decisions on party lines, and that he would try to persuade his fellow justices to put the institutional legitimacy of the court above their own ideological agendas and to converge on narrow, unanimous opinions. So why has he had, let's say, mixed success in this goal? He's obviously had some success when he himself could cast a tie-breaking vote, as he did in the Affordable Care Act, and I think he gets huge credit for having done that, for putting institutional legitimacy first. But there are a lot of other cases, like the voting rights case and like affirmative action cases and so forth, which are 5-4 on party lines. Why is it? You know, I asked Justice Ginsburg this too, and I think she said, you know, people have very strong views and they're not going to compromise. And when it's possible to narrow an issue, they will. And, you know, on the margins, you can maybe avoid these splits. But if one believes strongly in something, as Chief Justice Roberts told me this too, he said, I have strong views that I'm not talking about muddling and compromise. If he believes the Constitution requires colorblindness or the First Amendment prohibits campaign finance regulation, there's going to be some cases where he's just not going to compromise. So I think it's really these conflicting impulses. On the one hand, the desire for institutional legitimacy, and on the other, the strong views that all the justices have. Justice Ginsburg, interestingly, said she viewed it, her role, she's now the leader of the liberal dissenters, because at the senior associate justice in dissent, she can either write the dissent herself or assign it to the justice she thinks will do the best job. She's trying to convince the liberals to converge around a single dissent because she thinks it's stronger and clearer. She thought in Bush v. Gore it was too confusing for the country to have all these splintered opinions. So I think she's making, to the degree that Roberts wants to avoid these 5-4 decisions and prefers unanimous opinions written by the Chief Justice, Justice Ginsburg is not buying into that vision. She thinks when the liberals disagree, they should converge and be quite strong about what they actually think.
She is such a fascinating member of the court, and in part because she looks so tiny and so frail, and yet when you read her opinions, there's nothing frail about what she has to say.
This was one of my favorite conversations at the Constitution Center. As I told her, she's been on fire recently. She may look small and frail, but her writing is just more powerful than ever. And I think I asked her why, you know, you've spent so much of your career being a judicial minimalist and a judge's judge and being quite cautious. Why have you found your voice in this exciting way? And she said the role has changed, that basically now that she is the leader of the liberals, she views it as her role to speak for the liberal bloc in a way that she didn't before. And she's been giving a lot of interviews and been much more outspoken. And I think that's why she's doing what she's doing.
How do you see Justice Scalia? He was interviewed, and there was a piece in The New Yorker about him.
Fascinating interview, very outspoken, as always, incredibly entertaining. And Ginsburg, of course, are united by their shared love of opera. And at the Constitution Center, she recited some lyrics from this new opera that's been written about the two of them. It's called Scalia-Ginsburg. It's written by a young composer called Derek Wang. And I think the two of them are trapped on a desert island. And in order to escape, they have to agree on some common method of constitutional interpretation. And in fact, we're talking to the composer about having the premiere here in Philadelphia, possibly with the Curtis Institute.
Did she sing anything, or
she recited some lyrics? She recited the lyrics very interestingly, and although she does, you know, she loves opera.
Yeah.
But Scalia is, in that recent interview, talked about the fact that he still feels embattled, that he is more interested in influencing future generations of law students than he is in necessarily winning majorities. But he, I thought, last term had one of the best dissents I've ever heard. Here's another example of breaking ideological grounds. In a case involving DNA surveillance, when he, writing with most of the liberals, except for Justice Breyer, who voted with the conservatives, said that it's wrong for the police to be able to take a DNA sample from someone on arrest and store it in a database forever. He said the framers of the Constitution would have been appalled by these warrantless searches. And that dissent has obvious implications for the debate over NSA surveillance and whether or not it's permissible to hoover up all of our telephone records without a warrant as well. So there's an example of Justice Scalia defending the Fourth Amendment because he thinks that the framers would have insisted on it.
Well, and I know you have written a lot about the NSA program and have been critical of it. Do you see eventually something involving surveillance will make it to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Justice Scalia himself said yes, he expects the NSA surveillance cases to get before the Supreme Court. There are several different challenges to them, including one by the Electronic Privacy Information Center that says that the PRISM program, which hoovers up all domestic, international, and local telephone metadata, although it presumably only examines the metadata with some degree of individualized suspicion, the claim is that that violates the Fourth Amendment's requirement of a warrant, and that might well go up to the Supreme Court, according to Justice Scalia.
And when you say Hoover, you mean vacuum up, right?
Well, technically, I don't. Yes, Hoover is the old okay. Old vacuum phrase.
I want people to think of a Hoover Dam or something like that.
No, collect every single bit of phone calls, yes. Hoovers are old. Do people even use those vacuum cleaners?
I don't know whether they still use Hoover vacuum cleaners. I'm sure someone will call and let us know. We actually have an email from Nick from New Brunswick. He was concerned about money being equated to speech and the wealthy minority. Could he comment on this? We touched on this earlier about money and campaigns and speech and certainly some of these super PACs that have just gobs of untraceable money that can be very influential.
Yes. As the caller or writer suggests, not everyone agrees that money is speech. And you might even say that the court was wrong in Buckley versus Valeo to distinguish between contributions and expenditures. The more pro-regulatory position would have said that both expenditures and contributions could be regulated because money is not speech. Speech is speech. That's why it's the options in this case are so interesting. Some justices want total deregulation where only disclosure requirements are allowed, and that supposedly takes care of corruption, but otherwise neither expenditures nor contributions can be regulated, and some liberal justices go the other way and allow both to be regulated.
Let me ask you about another case that's going to be before the court. It's a McCullen v. Coakley having to do with buffer zones around abortion clinics and whether that restricts people's free speech rights. There's a kind of a theme here. We're talking a lot about free speech rights, and it seems buffer zones is an issue that has been before the court before.
It has. There was a case called Hill versus Colorado, which sustained a more modest buffer zone. And the question here is whether the court will uphold this Hill case and distinguish the Massachusetts zone on the grounds that it's larger than the one in Colorado. And it's also, the claim is that this is content and viewpoint based in the sense that clinic employees who support the clinic's mission are allowed to enter the clinic and go through the zone, whereas protesters are not allowed to go near the clinic. And that distinction didn't exist in the Colorado case. Mm. It's possible, though, that the court could overturn that Colorado case and say that no buffer zones are permissible, which would be a big change in the law because many states have them. And that would be another example of using the First Amendment to strike down a regulation. It's interesting, the court has changed since the 2000 Hill decision. It came down in 2000. Justice O'Connor has been replaced by Justice Alito. Alito is often willing to reject First Amendment claims in the service of socially conservative values. He's written lone dissents, 8-1 dissents, in cases involving funeral protests, for examples, or very graphic federal law, banning crush videos for animals. The court, very wrenching case, the court struck down that law on First Amendment grounds. Alito was the only dissenter. However, this is a case where the socially conservative policy views and the First Amendment arguments point in the same direction, which leads some to think that maybe Alito might vote to overturn the buffer zones.
Interesting. And that's Jeffrey Rosen, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, president and CEO of the National Constitution Center. We are talking about the U.S. Constitution and the U.S. Supreme Court and some of the cases being argued before the court this session. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499 and taking emails at radiotimes@whyy.org. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Delaware Theater Company presents the 3-time Tony Award-winning comedy Lend Me a Tenor, October 16th through November 3rd. A raucous farce featuring 5 doors, 8 actors, and nonstop laughter, Lend Me a Tenor delights in its own sense of abandon. As the opera's world-famous star goes missing, chaos on a truly operatic level ensues, starring Philadelphia veteran actor Tony Braithwaite. Tickets at 302-594-1100 or DelawareTheater.org. The Delaware Theater Company supports WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of Jeff Bezos and Amazon. We talk with Brad Stone. His new book, The Everything Store, chronicles Amazon's evolution from a website delivering books through the mail into a technology powerhouse that has forever changed the way we shop and read. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The field of behavioral health is changing, and changing rapidly. From innovative new web applications that help people take charge of their treatment and recovery to upgraded crisis facilities that offer serene environments, we're changing the way we care for those with mental health diagnoses. On the next Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, taking patient care to the next level. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Again, Jeffrey Rosen, our guest, president and CEO of the National Constitution Center. This program note, on Tuesday, October 29th, the center will unveil its first Town Hall Tuesday. These are panelist discussions, and on Tuesday the 29th, a debate about the government shutdown and the debt ceiling crisis or crises, and something we have been talking quite a bit about on Radio Times. We can also talk to you at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get to, it looks like Jack from media to join our conversation. And Jack, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to know why, if corporations have the same rights as individuals, why do they never get called into court for their transgressions?
You mean like the corporation called into court, you mean?
Yeah, if the court violates the law in any way, nobody goes into jail. Nobody gets fined. So I don't understand that.
Well, Jack, let me see what Jeffrey Rosen has to say.
It's an interesting and important question, and it's a sort of complicated answer. The legal status of corporations changes in different contexts. A corporation certainly can be sued. The question of whether a office holder in a corporation has to testify, whether he can plead the Fifth Amendment or not, or whether there's immunity from the need to testify is all complicated. But the big question in Citizens United in these campaign finance cases is whether corporations have First Amendment rights in particular. And the Citizens United case said they do. And that claim is being expanded. We talked about the contraception case. I should have noted that the claim there is that corporations are persons that have religious freedom expression rights, that basically the non-religious-based corporations themselves need to have their religious rights protected as well. So it's not true that corporations are immune from legal suit. They can be sued and they have legal liability. But the question really now is, how broad are their First Amendment rights, and that's what's being expanded by these recent cases.
Which just underscores the importance of that decision, that Citizens United decision.
It was very important, and we now know that Chief Justice Roberts originally didn't want to rule as broadly as he did. He had proposed a narrower ruling that would not have held that corporations have the full free speech rights of individuals, but would have simply said that video on demand is not covered by the campaign finance laws, and therefore that the makers of this anti-Hillary Clinton documentary, Citizens United, could proceed. That narrower holding would have avoided this big debate we're having about whether corporations have the same rights as people more broadly, and it's an example of how a broad ruling can really sweep much more dramatically.
Jack, thanks for the call to Radio Times, and again, that phone number 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. Let's talk about another case that's going to be before the Supreme Court. It's called Town of Greece v. Galway, and this is a town that's in New York.
It is. And the question here is the constitutionality of legislative prayers. This town, it's a council where citizens come to do business, opens with a prayer. And many of the prayers have been Christian prayers, although recently it was opened up and there have been one or two Wiccan prayers and so forth. And the question is whether that's consistent with the First Amendment's prohibition on an establishment of religion. Interestingly, the Obama administration surprised lots of people by filing a brief on behalf of the town and basically saying there is an exception for legislative prayers, a historical exception. The very first Congress opened its session up with a prayer. Congress continues to open sessions with a prayer. And basically, we're going to treat legislative prayers as different from other forms of religious expression and give them a pass because they're historically based. The Supreme Court could rule narrowly in that way, and if it did that, it wouldn't really change things. Or it could rule broadly. It could say that public religious expression is fine, whether it's a prayer or before a legislature or even before a high school football game. as long as the prayer is neutral among sects and doesn't favor one religion over another. That position, call it religious supremacism, is one that Justice Scalia and Thomas have embraced.
Hmm.
We don't yet know what Justices Roberts and Alito think about that, but that would be a big change in First Amendment jurisprudence to say that the state can openly endorse religion as long as it doesn't discriminate among sects. And this is the first big case where this Roberts Court has had the chance to show us what it thinks about this question of religious supremacism, which means it could be narrow and probably more likely to be narrow. But if it's broad, that would represent a big, big change.
And by sect, you mean someone who's a Wiccan who was able to have the opening prayer or whatever that's called.
Correct. You can't say, even Justice Scalia would say, you can't have only Episcopalians who can pray. But he says as long as it's open to any religion, that's fine, even though non-believers are excluded.
Oh, they are. Because my understanding for this town was that they at least had invited atheists to have an opening statement. But I don't know, you know, whether that how true that is. Or not.
This town did. Scalia's position, though, is broader, that you don't even have to invite the atheist, that basically it's fine to have open religious expression that discriminates against non-believers as long as it doesn't discriminate among sects. But I think this town, after initially being criticized for having mostly Christian prayers, did try to open it up a bit.
Let me see what it looks like. Jim from Lawrenceville, New Jersey has to say. And Jim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, Jim.
I was wondering, what sort of stipends are paid to the Supreme Court justices when they go out into the public and give their views and talk to different groups? And secondly, isn't it more appropriate for their views to be expressed through their opinions rather than to these public forums where they sort of slant their views? And aren't those groups a little bit influencing the justices by their stipends?
Jim, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Go ahead, Jeffrey.
Important questions. The Supreme Court, uniquely among federal judges, is not bound by the rules of judicial ethics that bind other federal judges. They've exempted themselves from those. I think there are limits on honoraria and so forth for other judges. Those do not apply to the Supreme Court, although the court may voluntarily choose not to accept stipends. Some justices have been criticized on both sides of the political aisle for appearing before for political groups on the claims, on the grounds that this might influence their decisions. Justice Thomas was criticized for appearing before an event with the Koch brothers and so forth on precisely that claim, and liberal justices have done the same thing. The counterargument is they're not going to be influenced. They know what they think, and there's no evidence of actual corruption, you know, on the court. But the claim of whether or not the Supreme Court should be bound by the same rules of judicial ethics that bind other judges is very much alive, and there are some lower court judges who feel that they really should be.
Oh, and that would be an interesting case for the court to rule on, wouldn't it?
Well, if, for
or
example,
would they have to excuse themselves?
Well, excellent question. Say that the judicial conference decided to include Supreme Court justices, and the justices said no, that only they can decide to apply this to themselves. Who would decide it, and could they recuse themselves? The mind reels. Who will guard their guardians is obviously a tough question, and it really is brought very acutely home in this particular case.
Yeah, it was a great question, but it does seem that justices are more public. They write books, they give more talks, they give more speeches, interviews, all of that.
It is remarkable. I've been covering the Supreme Court as a journalist for more than 20 years. When I started off, they just didn't talk to the press. They would occasionally give a decorous public appearance before a school. But just the variety and scope of these interviews, Justice Scalia in New York Magazine, Justice Ginsburg, and so forth. Basically, my position now, of course, is justices should give interviews, but only at the National Constitution Center. So if they want to come to Philadelphia, that's great.
No, you cannot limit our speech like that.
But I guess I can. No, they're my First Amendment instincts, and my professional ones diverge. But I think it's a serious question open for debate about whether the court is serving itself by being so public. After all, inaccessibility breeds authority. It's sort of the Wizard of Oz quality of the court. No cameras in the courtroom, the red velvet curtains that makes the court more respected than the other branches of government, according to the recent polls. Even though the court's approval ratings have been going down, they're going down less than the other institutions. As the justices begin to make themselves accessible, just like everyone else in our celebrity culture, that aura of mystery may be challenged, and therefore their sense of authority may be challenged as well.
But it seems we live in a time when people want more transparency, and you have more access to information. And so it is weird that there aren't cameras in the courtroom, that to some degree it is walled off from our very prying culture.
It remains one of the few non-video aspects of our government. Justice David Souter used to say cameras would come in over his dead body. He's now off the court. I think Justice Kagan, Elena Kagan, has said in interviews she expects within time, I don't think she gave an exact number, but within 5-10 years, eventually there will be cameras.
Yeah. Let me see what looks like Larry from Newtown has to say. Larry, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Following up on what an earlier caller had asked, I still fundamentally do not understand if a corporation has been created as an entity that is not an individual person, but a protected situation, a separate business legal entity, how can they argue before the court that they are entitled to free speech rights and contributions as such and be treated almost as an individual?
Well, it's a good question, and it's one worth wrestling with. Go ahead, Jeffrey.
I think Justice Kennedy, in his majority opinion in the Citizens United case, traced the history of corporations having free speech rights, and he claimed that at the time of the framing of the Constitution, I'm trying to remember the examples that he gave. They may have been newspapers or something like that. Had free speech rights that were recognized. Now, Justice Stevens rejected the analogy. He said there's a special status for the press, as evidenced by the press clause of the First Amendment, which is distinct from the speech clause. The First Amendment guarantees freedom of speech and of the press. And Stevens said newspapers, professional corporations devoted to journalism are different. The framers would have been appalled by the idea that corporations had full free speech rights. In fact, said Stevens, the framers had a horror of monopolies, and they believed that class legislation designed to favor big business over the interests of individual citizens was one of the central offenses against equality. So just reading the dissenting and majority opinions in Citizens United on this very historical question is fascinating.
It is fascinating, but I think Larry's question indicates, very unsettled. It's an unsettling decision for so many people.
You know, the wonderful and challenging thing about constitutional law is that things are never settled. There are strong arguments on all sides of these questions. Never trust someone who says the answer is clear or obvious. It wouldn't be before the Supreme Court if it were. The justices disagree. And the role of the National Constitution Center is to host debates that make these disagreements open, and then let citizens make up their own minds.
Larry, thanks for the call. Let me see what Kathy from Chester County has to say. Kathy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. I wanted to comment on the, I think it was Justice Alito, dissenting on the crush videos, the decision by the Supreme Court. Obviously, they elected to decide to protect the animals. But it's interesting to me because I think that something of that nature would certainly fall under obscenity. Because if obscenity is really a moral litmus test of the community, I'm trying to decide if it's still under that. And then secondly, it's interesting that Justice Alito would dissent on principle. To me, principle and allowing crush videos do not go together.
Well, that's a very interesting comment. Go ahead, Jeffrey.
It's a fascinating comment, and it's very consistent with the position Justice Alito took, that essentially there should be broad power in the community to ban speech on moral grounds that just offends community values, and that there's some things that are so shocking and prurient that even though they may not technically qualify as obscenity according to the Supreme Court's rather arduous tests, that the community should be able to protect itself for that reason. But what was so interesting in that case is that he was the only justice who took that position. All of the other ones said the First Amendment interest trumped.
Interesting. Kathy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. One other case is before the Supreme Court has to do with recess appointments. And President Obama appointed three people to the National Labor Relations Board. And this was, I guess, last Christmas when the Senate was, I guess, technically not in session, although they have ways of kind of staying in session technologically. And this has to do, I guess, with executive power and the power of a president to make appointments.
It's a hugely important case. The question is whether a practice of recess appointments going back to, at least 100 years is impermissible, violates the separation of powers. If the court agrees with the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit and rules broadly that both what are known as intercession and intrasession recess appointments are unconstitutional, it would mean that scores or hundreds of appointees might have their offices called into question. So it's not just whether the National Labor Relations Board had a proper quorum when it voted in this case with someone who'd been appointed through a recess appointment, right, but more broadly whether this practice, embraced by Republican and Democratic presidents, is or is not permissible. And the court could rule narrowly or it could rule broadly, but the consequences are very large indeed.
Because it has to do with this balance of powers, right, between the executive and between the legislative branches of government.
That's right. The president has relied on his ability to appoint people not only during the breaks between congressional sessions, which are known as intra-session appointments, but also during brief recesses during a session, which are known as intra-session.
Right. And sometimes just a couple of minutes, right?
Some people say this is just a ruse. Congress is going in and out of session for a second just to allow the president to make these appointments. But it's been a practice that goes back at least 20 years or so that these intra-session appointments have been relied on. And the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit struck them down.
Jeffy Rosen, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Such a pleasure to be here, always.
Nice to have you with us as well. And some things to think about as the U.S. Supreme Court continues to hear arguments. And again, Jeffy Rosen is the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, also legal affairs editor of The New Republic. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. We have podcasts as well, and we have Facebook and Twitter, and you can check out our archives on Radio Times as well. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Bilder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us. And come